One of the things I love best about living where I do is the nighttime view in winter, looking down on the Oxford Exchange. When it's an especially busy time of year, like it has been recently, the lights are even brighter, and one can almost be deluded into thinking that the red taillights of the many shoppers' cars are part of the Christmas decorations. Looking down upon this scene lends a sense of both excitement and peacefulness. The downside of living in an urban area is that the man-made lights overwhelm the beauty of the stars in the night sky. Or maybe I'm just so busy looking down that I forget to look up. I wonder if there was such a star as the one that shone over the manger in Bethlehem, if I would even notice. Or would I be so distracted by the man-made light, either at the Oxford Exchange or from my HDTV, that the light in the sky would never warrant my attention? Thankfully, the wise men, the kings, were paying attention. Certainly, they depended on the night sky to foretell many things. These, presumably three, were astronomers. They were scientists. They studied the night sky, watched, plotted the movement of the stars and the moon, and made predictions based on their studies. These were no rank amateurs. They were scholars. And not just scholars, but scientists. The story of the wise men from the East pairs science and religion. Imagine that. These attentive scholars looked up and immediately noticed that something important is going on. The stars and their patterns are the same, but there is a new one much brighter than the others. And rather than sitting around and discussing what this might be or why this might have occurred, rather than speculating on the nature of such an event or convening a committee to analyze the situation, they take off to see what has occurred. History has told them that a great star in the sky is an indicator of the birth of a new king. So they take off and see. But before they go, they pick gifts to present to this king. And the gifts that they take are not just trinkets or thoughtless items that they grabbed on the way out the door. The gifts they bring have deep meaning. Gifts are so tricky. So much so that they can almost be devilish. It's so difficult to find just the right thing for all the folks on your list. It's so hard to buy something for someone who has everything they need and more. There's so little meaning in a paper shredder or a new razor. Many of us have resorted to giving monetary donations to charitable organizations on behalf of our families and friends at Christmas time. Providing clean water to those in need, or a chicken or cow as a sustainable income for a family in a third world country, seems preferable to yet another tie or a pair of pajamas. Still, finding just the right match for the person on your list, even the right charitable gift, can be difficult, not to mention giving gifts without strings attached. I'm not talking about bows and ribbons here. I'm talking about those invisible strings tied tightly with the expectations. And if appropriate gift giving for our friends and family were not difficult enough, what on earth would one give the Christ child? The gifts presented by Melchior, Balthazar, and Gaspar, the legendary names of the three star-following kings, those who started our own Christmas gift-giving tradition, the gifts that they bring are gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And as I said, these are not just incidentals picked up just to have something to present to a family with a new baby. These are not your everyday baby gifts, not even in ancient Palestine. Legend has it that Gaspar brought the gold, Balthazar brought frankincense, and Melchior brought myrrh. Matthew's gospel account doesn't give us these details. Matthew doesn't even give the number of wise men. We presumed it to be three because there were three gifts. Surely, wise men or magi or priests or astronomers would not show up empty-handed at the manger cradling the Messiah. But Matthew doesn't want us to focus our attention too much on the persons, but on the gifts, which are named. Gold is given in acknowledgement of the kingship of this special infant. Frankincense acknowledges his divinity. Incense is offered with prayer to God. One would not give frankincense to the run-of-the-mill baby. This gift has significance, not to the baby, but to us. The gift of frankincense tells us these foreign dignitaries know who this is in full, even when others in his life do not and will not acknowledge his divine nature. These travelers from afar know from the minute they witness the rising of this new bright star. The third gift is myrrh, a spice for embalming. Myrrh is said to be presented to indicate Christ's humanity, to acknowledge the fact that he will die. These three gifts clearly describe this infant, king, divine, human. The Magi did well with their gifts. While these aren't run-of-the-mill baby gifts, they are right for this infant. But what would we give? If gift-giving is so difficult for our family and friends, how much more difficult is it for the Christ child? One of my favorite Christmas stories is one my father used to read to us every year during Advent, back when we were Methodist and called it Christmas. It's a story called How Come Christmas. And in this story, a minister of a small rural African-American congregation is trying to explain to his children's Sunday school class what Christmas is all about. It's a lot like Sermon on the Steps. It gets a bit out of hand when the children get 4th of July and Christmas and Santa Claus all confused. The minister does a marvelous job of weaving all together into a story where old Sandy Claus brings the poor little Jesus boy a bright, shiny apple to the manger, in part because that's the only thing he and Miss Claus have in the house, but also because he knows that the poor little Jesus would love to look at that bright, shiny apple. Still, what would we bring? What could we give the babe in the manger? One of our Christmas hymns may come to mind when you consider this question. In the last verse of the hymn, "In the Bleak Midwinter," this question is posed. What can I give him, poor as I am? If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. Yet what I can give him my heart. Certainly, that's the right answer. Give him your heart. But what does that mean? We 21st century folks do not have a real good track record for giving someone our heart, at least not in the permanent sense. And we Episcopalian pride ourselves in not being the happy, clappy, emotional-driven sort. So what does it mean for us to give Jesus our heart? Matthew, the teller of the story of the wise man who followed the star and brought such appropriate gifts to the Christ child, just 4 chapters after this one, has Jesus tell us exactly what it means to give him our heart. Jesus says, "Do not store up treasure on earth, where rust and moth destroy and thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasure in heaven, where neither moth nor rust consumes, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And where your heart is, there your treasure will be also. Where's your heart? Where's your treasure? Check your checkbook register. Check your credit card statement. That'll give you a really good idea about where your heart is. Does your heart belong to Christ? That's what we have to offer. Ourselves, our hearts, our minds, our lives. Our bank statements reflect who we are, what we value, what are our priorities, where our hearts are. Bank statements and credit card statements are private matters. No one sees them except us and God. Where's your heart? Amen.